Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from Incredibly Strange Films, Film and Stuff, and, of course, Deviant Legion. And today we are going international art house in our commentaries. We're going to be doing a film called Manila and the Claws of Light, directed by Luis Broca. And with me is a very close friend of the podcast. He's a fine film historian and reviewer, also from the Philippines. And that would be Noel Vera. Noel, nice to have you with us, man.
How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. Doing well. You know, I was checking the Criterion Channel, and I saw this, and I thought, well, this would be a perfect thing to have Noel on, because we've never done a commentary watch of Filipino films. We've done some art house films and foreign language films, but never here. And you're like one of the best. Well, you're the best historian I know as far as Filipino films, but also in the country, I would believe. So just give us a little background on the film and so on and so forth before we start.
Well, it's Mike De Leon production. He was producer. He founded a new company called Cinema Artists Philippines. And he was impressed with this hotshot new director, Lina Broca, who had done two previous films, Tinimbangkang Winikulang or You Were Weighed and Found Wanting, and Tatlo Dalawa Isa, 3-2-1. And he hired him to adapt a film of Edgardo Reyes's Sa Mga Kuko ng Liwanag, or In the Claws of Neon. I think that's the better translation. And this is based on Edgardo Reyes's life as a construction worker and as a gopher in a brothel in Chinatown. So, and then also Mike De Leon acted as a cinematographer. And that's basically the background.
Okay, well, fair enough. Well, this is on Criterion Channel. And you need to search Manila and the Claws, and that's C-L-A-W-S, of Light. Just to let everyone know, when you're dealing with a Criterion film, there's all sorts of pre-titles. Now, we have skipped all those. And let me just tell you where we are in the film. We are at 1:33 into the film. It is a blank screen. And then within a couple seconds, the first scene comes up, which is the streets of Manila. So what we're going to do now is get yourself set up. If you have to pause the podcast, please do. And now what we're going to do is we're going to start the film. I do a countdown, and basically to describe it is 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then I say go, and that's when we start. So, Noel, are you ready?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to start the countdown now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so movie starting, and we come on black and white scenes of Manila, and this is downtown Manila, somewhere in the neighborhoods of Santa Cruz and Binondo. And you can see these are not cleaned up. These are not sets. This is about as gritty as a film noir, and Broca gets style film noir can get, especially in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You get the titles of the people. Yes, the canals. There are canals crisscrossing Manila. We have the title. And like I said, my preferred translation is Manila in the Claws of Neon. Not in the Claws of Light. It's morning. They're just opening the stores. You have a lot of homeless in the streets. Absolutely. And in recent years, at least in the 2000s, I can tell you that nothing much has changed. They still have those calesas, those horse-drawn carts. And, you can pay to have them give you a ride. They're basically a tourist trap. No one actually uses them for practical purposes. If anything, the traffic's probably worse nowadays. You see a Jeep drive by, and those are the workhorse public transportation of Philippine society. And notice, this is all the work of Mike De Leon. He's a cinematographer, we said before. He's done one previous film. He shot one previous film, Eddie Romero's Aguila. And he likes a realist, functional, no-nonsense type of film style.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I'm seeing a lot of documentary style direction here.
And you see the shots here. You see the shot here, several streets converging. And then we zoom in on our hero. That's Julio Magiaga, or Bembo Rocco. And then it changes to color, Wizard of Oz style. And you see he'll be moving to a street corner, which actually has allegorical or symbolic significance. And this is where he will spend most of his time, on this street corner. Let's see if we can see the sign in a moment. Called Misericordia Corner Ongpin. Misericordia is Latin for, or Spanish for, misery. And Ongpin is... historical figure. He's Chinese man. His name was Roman Ongpin, and he helped fund the Katipunan, which is was the rebel group that helped overthrow the Spanish. And in history, he also went on to fight against the American occupation. So we're talking of standing between a corner of misery and revolt. This is an idea brought up by American writer Chadwick Jenkins, although he misidentified the neighborhood. It's not in Binondo. It is in Santa Cruz, Manila, where, incidentally, my wife grew up. She grew up nearby Oroquieta Street. Now, you can see that this is one of the few things that people without a college education can apply for, construction job. This guy's name is Mr. Balahadia, the guy in red. It's played by Pancho Pelagio. And you can see he is definitely the kind of goon thug type, except he's well-dressed because he's a foreman. He'll be typecast as a villain here. Broca often deals in stereotypes. He deals in melodrama. He grew up on melodrama, doing melodrama films. So that's his orientation, to think in melodramatic terms. Now, you see that Bembo Rocco, the man who plays, the actor who plays Julio, he's, I won't say he's skinny, but he's not exactly chubby. Interesting fact here, the original actor who played, who was supposed to play him was Jay Ilagan. And if you look at the outtakes, the extras in the Criterion collection, you'll actually see footage of Jay Ilagan in several scenes that Bembo plays. And the only problem is he's a great actor, Jay Ilagan, but he was chubby. And this point where he faints from hunger, you can't imagine Jay Ilagan fainting from hunger because of his excess weight. So Mike De Leon made the decision to cut him out and replace him with this guy, Bembo Rocco. And the interesting thing about this guy is he'd worked with Broca before. He played the gay man in a play by Broca, Lino Broca. Hanggang dito na lamang at maraming salamat po. Up to here, please, and thank you very much. And he found him in a D.A.R.E. program. That's a drug rehabilitation program. So this guy was an addict formerly before becoming an actor. And you can see there's really very something that's a recurring theme that you'll see in this film is that workers, people in the margin, have very little support system, social support system to count on. All they can rely on is themselves.
Or perhaps each other.
Yeah, on each other. They help each other out the best they can, as much they can. So this solidarity among fellow marginalized, that's going to be a recurring theme you'll see. You can see the cutting. Cutting, I believe, is by Ike Harlego. And he used to be a child actor. And if you listen, there's singing right now.
Okay.
By this character named Denny. I don't know if I can find this name. Anyway, one of the few tracking shots. Mike Dayon did indulge in tracking shots once in a while. And he's singing a popular Filipino pop song. Well, not Filipino, but definitely a pop song. I don't know if I can get Benny's name here. Yeah.
So let me ask you something here. So these people are on the construction site. Are they taking a break, or is this how they live?
They take a break.
Okay.
They have housing nearby. Yeah, they have housing nearby, usually on the construction site. But right now they're taking a break. And one guy's trying to ask another. By the way, Benny's the actor playing Benny's Danilo Posadas. And they're asking about him. How come he fainted from hunger? Doesn't have a lot of money.
Right.
And construction work, something you fall into, usually out of desperation if you're able-bodied. They don't like his singing. And some of them are actually family workers. Now, the luckier ones are single and they don't have anyone to worry about. Others have to support their family on. Yeah, 7 pesos. That's basically $1 a day.
God.
So they get $7 a week. And he's only only gets $2.50. Yeah, what you got?
Yeah. So I'm just wondering. You know, this was a representation of the time and what the conditions were at the time. As far as if your workers and that sort of thing, have there been any improvements in terms of like maybe unions or something to help these people? Or is it as bad as it's shown here?
Okay. There are unions, but there's also a lot of unions breaking. Okay?
Right.
There's a lot of fighting against the unions. The unions are recognized. The pay has improved, and I'll tell you how much it's improved. Right now, construction workers in the Philippines get 332,000 pesos a year, and that's the equivalent of $6,000 a year. It's improved.
Okay.
It hasn't improved that much. And you have to consider inflation probably accounts for some of that. And the foreign exchange back then, 7 pesos, $1 was equivalent to 7 pesos. Now it's 54 pesos to $1.
Oh, good Lord.
I know. So really, starvation wages, and still happening right now. Now we see a flashback. Julio Madjaga and Ligaya Paraiso, that's his love. They don't explain it, but you see that.
Well, the interesting thing is you can tell that they're flashbacks. Generally, flashbacks in American films, you know, will use some sort of trick like a fade in or fade out or that. But here it's just very matter of fact, but yet you understand that it's a flashback.
Yeah.
Or part of that is
classic
where
Hollywood
would
have a fade. Classic Hollywood would have a fade, or this would be coming out of the 70s. It would be coming out of a new wave, flashing back and forth in time or flashbacks.
Right.
Here and again about the salary, and they described earlier the Taiwan method, where they don't have the money to pay you, but they will lend you the money.
in the meantime at a 10% rate. So you are paying 10% interest on what should really be yours in the first place.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. So, yeah, they're, you know, I mean, we're in the midst of a strike right now. SAG-AFTRA and, of course, WGA. We just did a podcast on it. And people in control, they want more money and they want more control. And workers just get crap. Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Also about artificial intelligence and wanting to get your image and pay you one day's work for using that image for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, here you see they actually pitched in to give him money for cigarettes. Again, that's solidarity among workers. And it's not much, but it's all they've got.
Mm-hmm.
And this is their the makeshift shacks, probably on the construction site or nearby, and they get paid to they get to stay there.
Oh God!
And
like
Imo,
indentured servants.
Yep, Imo is one of the characters, and he's different. It stresses how, you know, sometimes an education is important.
Mm-hmm.
One way out of poverty, and which is the cliche way of thinking things, but that days you don't have much alternatives. It's either get an education or sell yourself some way.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, education, we do not have direct loans or Parent PLUS loans. We do not have a lot of scholarships or grants. There may be some, but hard to find, and usually it's the middle class or upper class who get those grants and scholarships because they have the information and the means of applying for them.
Right. And they're the last ones to have it. They have the money. They could pay for it.
Scholarships.
Yeah. In the case,
In
the case of my wife, her dad worked as in construction engineer in the other countries, in Guam. And they got the money, put her through nursing school, and she became a full-fledged nurse. So that's one way out. Like I said, she lived in Santa Cruz in Oroquieta. Conditions may be a little better, but not much better than this. So Imo is very ambitious. And we'll see how his subplot develops. Maynila, the novel, is barely 150, 130 pages long. I read it. Amazing book, but it has not been translated into English. Yeah, I'd love to do it someday if I had the money and time to do it. It was published as a series of installments in a magazine. Like Charles Dickens. Yeah. So they have a lot of subplots, and usually it ends with some kind of cliffhanger so that you'll want to read next week's installment. And again, he's remembering Ligaya Paraiso, played by Hilda Coronel, a Lina Broca protege. And this is their food, dried fish, rice. I'm not sure what the red stuff on that other plate is.
I would think that one of the major foods that you would get in the Philippines, of course, would be fish. That would be
because of the heat, it won't stay long, so they dry it as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the ways, and that goes back to ancient times, to preserve fish and preserve meat, was to dry it out with salt.
Yep.
They're talking about moving back to the provinces. That wasn't really an alternative to a lot of people there. They came to Manila from the provinces. And here you can see a flashback to the province. You notice how it seems cleaner. The air is fresh.
Right.
The outdoors are green. The water looks clear. That's kind of deceptive. And maybe one of the weaknesses that Tony Raines points out is how
yeah, he's a film critic, and you'll see his assessment of Manila here, is how it's not, it seems idealized, the provinces compared to the city of Manila.
Well, you know, I mean, that's kind of understandable, though, because if you're from the city and you're writing about the city and you're writing about the ills and that sort of thing, you need something that's the, you know, that's the idealized, you know, opposite of it. And that idealized opposite in this case would very well be the provinces and be the suburbs and living off the land and being a fisherman and that, not dealing with the ills of the city. So, I mean, that makes absolute sense. You know, you can sure. complain about it all you want, but, I mean, I get the idea. Film is not a novel. You know, you have to clearly delineate some of your points.
Okay, here we go. We're going to have, and this is interesting for how it works and doesn't work. Coming up is, then spoilers here, an accident. And
well,
I like the way how
the
bucket swings.
And then tell us. Don't tell us beforehand.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. And then here we go. And it cuts pretty quick. Too quick to register, and that may be a flaw that they can't help having. If you see the actual fall, there's a behind-the-scenes shot. He did drop like four stories, 40, 60 feet, into a lot of people holding a net. It wasn't like a safety bag like stuntmen have today. And I swear, it doesn't look like it's very big. It doesn't look like they could catch him. He was a sharp shooter. He was lucky he hit where he did and is still alive to tell the tale.
God.
Now, the smart thing is they may have cut because they only have so much usable footage. And you saw the actual, they ended up with using maybe a fraction of a second of footage. They linger on the after effects, people looking in shock.
Oh, yeah.
And spinning camera. To show all the, it's like an arena where people look down and people can't help looking at an accident at the desk. It's something to look at. It's in a perverse way, some kind of entertainer sent off.
But let's not forget, of course, you know, we talk about Filipino film and we've talked about it, you and I, both on and off the shows, the podcast. But, you know, we're talking about a film that probably was made for what? $10,000 at that. You know, they only have a very
$10,000-$20,000 probably.
Yeah.
And it's one of the better funded films because Mike DeLeon is producer. He was heir to the LVN Studios, one of the most successful studios in the 50s.
Okay.
His grandmother was Narcisa De Leon, Doña Sisang. What else? And here you get the sense that Edgardo Reyes had written the building, the building under construction to be some kind of beast, a giant monster that swallows up its workers. You don't get much of that sense here on film. It's a different thing, but it's still, you can see it's clearly an unsafe and hospitable place. Now, is it like that nowadays? I mentioned that there are unions, and they reported that as of today, construction work is like having one foot in the grave. 90% of Filipino workers said in 2018 that there's been an injury, illness in the workplace in the last 12 months, and only 8% have been trained in occupational safety and health. They're working on it. It's still a long way to go. And again, here again, a scene where they show the solidarity among workers. You're hurt.
Right.
we'll help you out because he can't go out to nurse. There's no on-site construction nurse. And that's all that's left for Benny. You know, a songbook with one of the most famous actresses, Nora O'Noor, on the cover. You see that pretty
face. I was
just going to
ask you that, actually. Yeah. Just going to ask you that.
And here are the squatters. It's Sunugapong. Burnt lime, that's the translation. And it's a squatter area. And you can see people, this is a slum. People come here from the provinces, they set up these houses. Now, there's some improvements. You will see power lines tapping electricity from transmission lines. And they'll have video players and TV sets and electric fans. But it's not much different. There's been some progress. Again, not a lot. Tell you this much about, let me see. 21 million people in, what's that?
Good God.
The realism.
I was just going to say the realism of how he's shooting this. And that. Take a look at the background where they're feeding someone, you know, who's obviously not well. You have a number of these things that are happening, and it's like I mentioned it before. It's very much documentary the way that he's setting it up. He's making a point of showing Manila in like the worst light he can, but also still there are humans here. And human lives.
Cinema verites, ultra-realism, or near-realism, if you like, from the tradition of Roberto Vasellini and Vittorio De Sica.
Exactly. You know, the near-realism of the Italians. And, of course, then you get into the French New Wave and all that. So,
and handicapped father, they're telling a story right now. And that's an old story, land grabbing by the rich. They'll take the farmer's land, and the farmer has very little recourse. In this case, instead of a wealthy Chinese, it's going to be a Spanish Chinese. So this, admittedly, a lot of xenophobia in this film, and that's a weakness of the film. But these are, you know, cases. They're actual cases. All the way from Jose Rizal's time, Noli Metangere, in the 1890s, he'd written about it, and it's still a case of land grabbing. I'm sorry, you were saying something.
Well, the thing that I'm noticing, and let's talk about the xenophobia at this point, and we have to realize what decade this is. This is the 70s. The 70s, no matter where you were, was a very, very depressing decade for film. You're looking at that also, if it's depressing, you've got to blame someone. So the language and all this and the prejudice and the xenophobia and that were all part of the landscape. And you're trying to show the landscape as it is at the time. So to take a look at this film from today's prism and say, well, yeah, and there's all of this and they don't treat women right, and that was sort of the point. They were showing that to like, you know, put it in a capsule, time capsule. So you can't judge. I would argue very strongly you cannot judge from today's prisms a film that comes from this decade or earlier decades. You really can't do it. You've got to sort of like put that aside and look at it on its own terms. There, I said my piece.
Sure. 4 million, no, I'm sorry. Like I said, the traditions from the French New Wave, that handheld shot, a lot of zoom-ins. You see that. You'll see it in Midnight Cowboy. For which, additionally, Lena Broca had auditioned for Midnight Cowboy to play Ratso Rizzo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If he had gotten there, Philippine cinema would have changed. The history would have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more about that, but I can't say it. But, yeah, he'd auditioned for that. Didn't work out, and he ended up being Philippines' great filmmaker.
I will tell you a story about John Schlesinger off podcast at one point or another. I'll tell you a story.
Also here we see now Jose Capiño had divided, if you see the Criterion essay, he divided the film into three segments, and the construction site segment is Julio being guided by his friend Atong. Atong, you see mm-hmm. Atong over here. And Atong is Lou Salvador Jr. And you'll see Atong in the process of dickering
right.
over, a piece of clothing.
Clothing.
Yeah. You'll see this in the market. I think they're in Arankin Market, one of the biggest markets in Manila. Maybe not. I know that we'll see Arankin Market later, and we'll definitely get a good look at it.
I love it that they go to each other. You're the bitch. No, you're the bitch. You're the bitch. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. And it's less than a dollar. He's bargaining it down to less than a dollar for a short sleeve, which is the fashion back then. And we didn't talk about this, but he spots what he thinks is the recruiter. She's Mrs. Cruz, and she had recruited Ligaya to come work as a domestic helper in Manila.
Mm-hmm.
Her actress name is Juling Bagabaldo, I think. Juling Bagabaldo. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Juling Bagabaldo. And you can see the press of the crowds, how claustrophobic, how crowded it is in the marketplace.
Yeah.
You go in there,
well,
and
you
it's
mentioned
like, oh,
there's
look
21 million, 21 million in Manila. I would have never guessed that. You know, I mean, New York City is like, and all the boroughs, it's like, what, 7 billion? 15.
7 million, yeah, I think so. Not. Manila spread out more, but Metro Manila spread out more. Now, Manila itself, it's really concentrated humanity there. They have a lot of eateries, and the food, let me tell you, looks good, actually.
Oh.
And point out the prices later. The prices are wild and crazy. I can't believe they can be that cheap.
Well, all I can tell you is you need to come to New York, or I need to go to you, and we need to eat some Filipino food together. Seriously.
Oh, you name me anything. I can show you where it's a good place to eat in New York.
Get to New
Chinese
York
food.
And I'll take you out.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Sure. Sure. Chinese food, you name it. Jewish deli food.
Oh, I know Jewish deli. Trust me on that.
Okay.
I have a friend of mine who's Orthodox Jewish. We go to collect kosher all the time.
Okay. Korean barbecue, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Live octopus in the Korean restaurant. Okay,
see,
so Atong
is taking it. Century egg. I need to try some century egg.
Century egg, durian, and balut.
Yep. I do that in a heartbeat. I try it. I love trying new foods.
Sure.
There's a curtain store. So if you need curtains, you go to the curtain store.
We pass by. There are a lot of stores here. Cinderella. It's closing time, and a lot of them are closed up. Some of the stores. Some stay up late, though. I'd say about 8, 9 o'clock in the evening. Now, this slum where Atong lives, and he brings him over to stay, I don't know if you know what's going on here. Do you have any idea?
Not particularly. So,
so he's talking about...
Okay, go ahead.
There's a shack where the construction workers, the shacks where the construction workers live, and someone brought a prostitute, and she's servicing all the men. She's servicing all the men, and he's saying, he's complaining that I spent all my money on her because, you know, she pushed it in my face. How can I resist? And, yeah, either the guard comes in and gets a cut of the girl's money or the girl had paid him, the construction site guard, to let them in. Okay, an exam book. So this is Imo, who's all about education. He's played by Pio de Castro III, and he becomes a filmmaker. Director and so on. And one of his best films, which I've seen, is Soltero, which stars the aforementioned Jay Ilagan, the one who was supposed to play Julio but was too chubby. Plays a man who's totally isolated and lonely. So it's a very good film. If there was ever a subtitled version, I'd love to do a commentary on that one too. But there's none right now. It's been restored, but there's no subtitled version. If you turn up the music, you can hear that this is Ligaya's theme.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty well known in the Philippines. Yeah, that voice in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Music's by Max Hoxon. And talking about gorgeous Hilda Coronel, probably the most beautiful faces in Philippine cinema. She was 18 years old when she did this film.
Wow.
Started as a child star, child actress, became a star eventually, and this is probably her biggest, one of her biggest role to date. And that's The Girl's Pimp.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not the construction worker. He's too well-dressed.
Right.
And here's the girl. And I believe I've seen her before. I believe she might be a member of PETA. That's the Philippine Educational Theater Association, which Lino has worked with and has been associated with. He will either hire actual construction workers or to be in the films, or he will hire stage actors because he comes from the stage and he's familiar with the stage. You can see, again, this neorealism, the process of building, of putting together a building. Not so much the beast that Eduardo Reyes describes in his book, but something that's forming out of the ground. And here we have a crucial scene. Mr. Balahadja will make an announcement.
Well, I've been involved in these type of announcements before. Where I was working, they were bought out, and the president of the company came out and like said, well, there's not going to be any difference. And I looked at him like, yeah, right. Give me a fucking break.
But in America, usually they call you into the office and they talk to you, right? It will be extra.
But in this case, they did all of us in a warehouse, just like this, just like this.
Now, a lot of the faces there are probably real construction workers. If we haven't known them before, we don't have any speaking lines. Likely, they're people who've been hired off the scene or nearby. Are working there.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps coming to this Chuat Peck Trading Company. He's haunting the place. And we'll find out later why. We'll see the casual cruelty of some Chinese employers, not a lot. like I said, there's a lot of xenophobia, not all of it unjustified, but maybe more than is warranted. It's not the issue that, you know, it take more than a commentary to deal with. I'm part Chinese myself, so I kind of feel for both sides of the
issue.
Yeah, yeah. And is that Ligaya? Probably. There's probably only one probably recognized profile right there.
Mm-hmm.
I might talk for a moment about Julio Majaga. His name is a play on words. Majaga sounds like machaga, which means patient in Tagalog. So he's Julio, patience. And Ligaya Paraiso translates as joyful paradise. Now, you have a woman named like that. What do you think? Either porn star or hooker's nickname.
Something like that.
It's ridiculous. But Edgardo Reyes had conceived these characters as allegorical. There's not much psychological insight in this beyond the fact that Julio's like a simmering pot ready to boil over. Like I said, in between the corner of misery and revolt, at certain points he'll have too much and he will revolt. We're going to buy
See, one of the things that I really like about doing this with you is you're bringing out stuff that I have no concept of knowing, because you know the language, you know all the play on words and that sort of thing. And American audiences and English speaking audiences and any foreign speaking audience is not going to catch that stuff. So I really appreciate what you're doing here.
Yeah. This catch-up exposition, we found out that the guy had been hired by Mrs. Cruz to be a domestic helper, and that the employer will help her with schooling.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happened. She ran away from home or whatever, but he knows it's an excuse. You see how skinny Bembo Rocco is in this scene? And that's a theme in Edgardo Reyes' book. Mrs. Cruz looks like a pig, a filthy pig. She looks like a pig, she acts like a pig, thinks like a pig, so on and so forth. That's something Edgardo Reyes' book harped on.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it's more caricature than complex psychological portrayal. What comes out in the book is...
Here we have
Times Square.
What looks like... Yeah, exactly. We have the business... and the tourist trap of Manila.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
The commercial side, the flesh spots and the pleasure spots.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just like the Deuce back in the New York City in the 80s and 70s.
And we see Paul, that's Tommy Abuel. He was a friend he'd hooked up with earlier. Met earlier. And we're going to see him again. I said there's like three segments here, and Atong is Julio's guide through the construction site segment. Paul will be in the Chinatown segment. He will be Julio's guide. There's like parallels with Dante's Inferno, you know, several circles of hell. These are the three circles of hell so far. We get the construction site where he's actually eating, not making a lot of money, but it's honest work. Then we'll move to the next circle of hell soon enough. And each circle, he has a guide, a male guide. This stuff isn't mine. It's from Jose Capino's essay.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Like I said, there's not something they don't make clear is that there's not a lot of jobs in the provinces. And fisherman, he said that he was a fisherman. No way you're going to earn a lot of money as a fisherman. It's a dying industry. The fishing industry has ships to take it all away from your hands. So people come to Manila for the jobs. And now he's saying about how he'd followed her to Chuatek's hardware store trading company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an important plot detail which bothered me for the longest time. He comes out the door, knocks on the door, and this is very typical of houses in the Philippines. You have this long, steep stairway, probably a wooden hallway, wooden stairs. And then you have this
mm-hmm.
kind of gate, swing gate or something, collapsing
right.
gate. And
you have a lot of those in New York, too. In the
city. Yeah.
They're basically for privacy and also to keep out all the ne'er-do-wells and thieves and such.
You notice, while he was inquiring, they never once opened the gate. So you can see how security-conscious and paranoid Atek is. Atek, incidentally, is played by Tommy Young. You'll see him in a lot of Filipino movies. He's a longtime Lena Broca collaborator. And here again, this guy's Chinese. He has money. Stereotype?
Mm-hmm.
Not true. I can tell that from personal experience. Not every Chinese is rich in the Philippines. The thing is, Chinese are looked upon like Jews are here in America. They're an insular group. They're very shy about reaching out. Throughout history, even at Jose Rizal's time in the 1890s and before that, there have been pogroms, raids on the Chinese community on Chinatown to burn their houses and beat up and kill a few Chinese. They may rise up and have positions of power, some of them, but they've also had it hard. There's been a lot of prosecution of the Chinese community.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really naughty issue that hard to see how they can fit it here or make any suggestion that maybe not all Chinese are here in B-Mobile.
Right.
Now he's being kicked off the construction site workers' sleeping quarters because he's not hired anymore. He's fired.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He has to move out. And Atong offers to, again, there's that theme again of we got to stick together, we got to look out for each other. And I can see we are almost to 1 hour mark.
Yep.
We haven't met Atong's sister, Perla. I haven't really talked about her. She's kind of a small side character, kind of important. And the father is another one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the pay practices are the same. They're probably different. Laws have been enacted, so on and so forth, but they've probably gotten around those laws. And there's some kind of, chicanery going on, some way of taking worker's pay somehow.
Well, just like you said, you can borrow money at 10% of money they fucking owe you.
Yeah, in the first place.
They'll find any way to do that.
Look at that. 250 pesos.
Mm-hmm.
He's earning 250 pesos probably a week, maybe?
Yeah.
In advertising, education. And it's a cliche, but like I said, it's kind of true. That girl, she doesn't have a name, the one in the middle of the alleyway.
Got it.
They think she's a prostitute. She probably is. She's longtime PETA
good looking
actress. Yes.
You'll see her again in Broca's other films, In Siang and Mario Harris, Tatlong Talong Walang Diyos.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Rizal Park. I've been here plenty of times. That's the Rizal Shrine to the far left. It disappeared now.
Okay.
That one. See that crossing across
yeah,
the screen?
Yeah, got it.
Small penis-looking thing. That's observatory in the background. That white dome. He's near Manila Bay.
Music.
Yes. Max Hoxon had to use a synthesizer. And yeah, that's a cliche all the way to the 90s. Not much you can do beyond go to synthesizer for movie music because they have to do it fast.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a lot of resources. Here, you can see Tony Raines complained that it looks like a shampoo commercial. And it's gorgeous in a shampoo commercial sort of way. But like you point out, there has to be some relief from all that dirt and grime. There has to be some
yes.
kind of contrast. You have to have a sense. It makes Manila look worse that somewhere else is much better or looks
mm-hmm.
much better anyway. Anyway, and this is the Breakwater. Mario Harrell will make a movie about this, The Woman of the Breakwater, Babay's Breakwater. The breakwaters where there's a lot of people over that wall living there. They actually have shacks out there. And you can see Julio's beating up a purse snatcher. And we see for the first time that Julio is capable of violence. There's all this anger
mm-hmm.
bottled down in him. He lost his girl, all the things that have been done to him. He's simmering, and the simmering is getting close to boiling over. Now, in the book, earlier in the book, Julio actually killed someone. And that makes him more complex. He is capable beyond. And you don't see him completely in sympathetic light. Lena Broca came to Mike DeLeon and insisted we cut that murder out early on. We want to have him as an innocent. We want to bring him down. A greater contrast. I see the argument for that. But that basically reduces it to a melodrama. Oh, we are now in the second circle of hell. You see back mm-hmm. there, NEC and Sanyo, those are Japanese companies, which gives you a hint of what's coming up next.
Okay, gotcha.
And we see some gay people staging probably an impromptu play or pretend to be in a beauty pageant, propositioning Julio.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the big problem with... something like cutting out that murder, and you see men, and you get a vibe from that, a certain vibe,
mm-hmm.
Is that Lino likes things black and white, and he'll push it as black and he'll push it as white as possible. There's extremes.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of subtlety, not a lot of modulation, and that may be the basic flaw of My Name is Akuko. By cutting out that murder, we make Julio a more simple, more innocent character. And that
and
robs
maybe that's
the film
exactly
of
where he wanted
complexity.
To go. I mean
he wanted
let's
to go
take
there,
a look
yes.
at that. Let's take a look at the decade. The decade is a lot about innocent people who are drawn into something, or maybe they're not so innocent, but they're drawn into something they can't control, and they turn up worse for it. If you take a look at most of the films that I love in the 70s, they all have downbeat endings at the very least, if not tragic endings. I look at, you know, the film that this reminds me most of is Jerry Schatzberg's Scarecrow, which
yeah,
is
yes.
Al Pacino and Gene Hackman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where you have two innocents who, because of things happen, one of them dies and the other one has no hope at the end. And that's what this seems like. You know, it has that feel to it for me.
Another one that would be close is Midnight Cowboy. And I'm sure that the look and feel of that film and the film style of the finished film influenced Pino Broca, especially as he's thinking, I could have been that guy. I could have been Razzo Hitzel.
Right.
We're meeting Bobby. Bobby is Giorgio Abella, and he is Julio's guide into the second circle of hell, the sex worker's hell. And what you'll see, you'll notice here, is that it's a little more well-to-do. There's more money in circulation. The workers are paid better, but it feels more degrading. The way sex work is practiced in the Philippines at this point, there's a lot of prejudice, a lot of hypocrisy against it. So they feel that. I guess they turn it inward. They internalize that hypocrisy, that hate towards them. And they say, well, we're damned anyways, and we'll do us what we please. And this is just this subset of sex workers, the gay sex workers. We haven't heard it yet, but we will find out just what Bobby's job is.
Well, you talk about gay sex workers. Let's talk about Broca, because he was a very out gay man.
He didn't start that first. He was very mums about it. Then he became more and more directly out. I'm not sure if it's in this film or later on that he comes out openly gay. But there was a while there that he was very coy about it.
Right. You know, and also I found little tidbit that interests me, that he became Mormon.
He was a Mormon before he started in film industry.
Okay. Now interests me. Go ahead.
Yeah. He worked in the West Coast, and that's how he got the audition for Midnight Cowboy. He wasn't good at following orders, kept questioning orders, so he was sent to a leper colony in Hawaii.
Okay.
And he worked there. He learned how to care for and love lepers there.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And then he went back to the Philippines, and then he became a successful, first a commercial filmmaker. He started in the 1970s. And then he moved in 1975. 1974, with Tinimbangka Nunikulang, he became known as artistic filmmaker, not just commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Artistically successful, as opposed to. Now, here's a controversy. Talked about by Tony Raines, Capino, and Mike Leon himself. These scenes of gay sex were not in the book. Edgar De Reyes is a straight man. He'll come out and say it directly himself. He has no experience of the gay sex industry. This was inserted on the insistence of Lena Broca. And some of it may be autobiographical. And here's the thing. Without permission from Edgar De Reyes. So that's on Broca. With approval of Mike De Leon, who was kind of reluctant. And then he thought that the gay scenes were kind of excessive. And he cut the lovemaking scene short. Now that one, if he cut it short, that seemed justified. You just see a glimpse of them through a mirror. And it just gives you an idea of what's going on. Okay, fine.
Right.
You know, you get the heads up. Okay, nothing's kosher. And here's an interesting thing. He'll say, I'm not queer. I've actually met people like that. Men who are being kept by rich gay boyfriends, and they actually live in the house with the gay boyfriend with their wife and kids. Or in the case of the one I'm thinking of, the wife is gone, but he takes care of the kids, and his mother is helping take care of the kids too.
And I lived with them for a few months. It was an interesting relationship, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, yeah, that is interesting, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. And they don't think of themselves as gay. And I'm saying, well, you identify as such, and nowadays the way of thinking is if you identify as such, then sure. That's how you say it. That's how you want it. They were ahead of their time. I don't identify as gay even if I'm doing homosexual acts. And the times have caught up with them. What can I say? Interesting, interesting.
No, and the other thing, too, you know, I mean, there's that old saying, you know, the guy's in prison and he says, well, you know what? $20 is $20. I'll do whatever. Right? And there's that sense of it, too. If you're in a place like Manila and you find a way to live and you have to rationalize to yourself that this is good, you know, I mean, I could see that to a certain degree.
However, I'm not even sure you'd call it rationalize. Nowadays, you'd say self-identify.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
but if you self-identify now, you're part of the community. Trust me. You can't say
sure.
I'm not gay.
You might say I don't identify as gay and still be doing the acts as part of my... apparently, that's a thing. That's a thing that's accepted now. So I'm saying, okay, I don't judge.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So this is a gay brothel. And apparently, it's a real brothel. Lena Brock has shot there.
Wow.
He's a regular customer. He knows these people. Some of these people are actual gay sex workers. And not left unsaid, Brock probably availed of their services.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are actors, though. I recognize some of their faces. I can't tell you off the top of my head right now. Let me see. Yeah, this guy with the striped shirt. Yeah. It's Cesar. He's the owner of the brothel.
Okay.
And his name is Chiqui Sarasburgas. That's the actor's name. I'm sorry, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And Cesar, being the madam, quote-unquote, of the place, will try out the new recruit.
Now, I watched a bit of this film to prepare, but I didn't
mm-hmm.
get this far, so I did not realize that we have a true gay subtext in this film, which is interesting for the time. Okay,
yep.
There for the American audiences, there were underground films, Kenneth Anger mm-hmm. and such, that definitely had gay themes. And you had The Boys in the Sand, which was one of the first hardcore films. But you know, you were relegated to go to Times Square to see these type of things, but you didn't have any real art films or any type of national release until well into the 70s. One of the first that I remember seeing was Outrageous, but that was, you know, that was more of a comedy.
Yeah, that was, what's his name, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robert De Niro, right?
No. This is way before Philip Seymour
okay.
Hoffman. This is way before. This is 1976 here. I'll get you the information here. It's just a second. It had one of the more famous drag performers. Just a second.
While you're looking,
Craig Russell.
77.
Craig Russell.
So who? Ken Russell?
Craig Russell.
Craig Russell. Got you.
Okay. The director is Richard Benham.
Then they cut it out. They cut short that scene. And it would have been interesting to know just how far he was willing to go, how far he you know, the, his reaction would have been interesting to see.
Yes.
Jose Capino, who wrote the Criterion essay, says it was due to reasons of length. They want to cut it for, you know, viewability, and that Mike DeLeon, the producer, had never restored it. Mike DeLeon counters, Jose Capino should do his research. I did it. He could ask me. I did it because I thought it's excessive. We know where it's going. We don't have to see it all the way.
Right.
And can't restore the cut scenes because they're gone. We don't have a practice of restoring excise scenes. When the footage is cut, it's burnt or used for something else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm in the middle ground. I would have liked to have seen it, if it was possible, at least the scene. Because we want to see Julio's reaction to how, you know, will he like it? Will he not like it? Will he, you know, be homophobic all the way? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It would been interesting to have seen his reaction. That's and also, it felt like it was cut short. Maybe we should, give it a few more seconds. It may be a more appropriate time to cut. Now, this is Julio's first customer, Ricky, and he's played by Ricky Jimenez. This is his initiation into gay prostitution. One reason why Lino Broca had included the scene is that later he and Ligaya meet. Well, I'll explain that later when we get to it. Prostituting your body is also another... another recurring theme in the film. And notice Michael used a red gel, and the light looks like they, you know, it's like another circle of hell, the
right.
Brothel rooms. Okay, I'm buffering here. I don't know why.
Why? Okay, I could tell you we're at 106:39.
Yeah, I don't know how long it's going to take.
Ah, shit. Ooh.
Just keep them going. Tell me what you're seeing, and I could like.
Okay, so we see the scene between our hero and his pickup.
Mm-hmm.
What you may want to do, as far as buffering, is get out and then get back in. That might help.
Okay,
I don't know.
I'll try to do that.
When you're back in, then I'll give you the time.
Yeah, just keep, and maybe I can just kibitz and say something.
Okay.
Describe what's going on.
Okay, so we've got the scene. The dog is at the end of the bed. They're getting the dog out. It's uncomfortable. You can tell that he's very uncomfortable with this.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is a scene that Mike DeLeon had cut short, but I would have liked to see it maybe a little longer, see how his reaction is.
Mm-hmm.
Would he experience pleasure? Would he panic at the experiencing pleasure? We don't know. Okay.
No. Now we're back in the streets. And in the slum.
Okay. Yeah, I've turned it on again. It's taking its time. I guess one problem of streaming is, you know, when you have a high traffic, it's probably high traffic time at 8 o'clock.
Right.
You have issues. Sometimes I've had to turn off my router.
Where are you, by the way? You're in
South
Pennsylvania,
Central.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
South Central Philly?
South Central PA.
Oh, okay.
I don't see a dang thing. I may have to turn off my router.
Okay.
What's going on?
So we've got him and his friend from the construction talking. And his friend is going somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where. Hold on. Going back to the trading company.
Yeah, you'll see him going back there all the time just because he thinks mm-hmm. Gaia might be there. I may have
to...
Well,
he sent his friend in and his friend is coming back. There's no Lagaya there.
Restart my computer as well. And there's thunderstorm.
Well,
I
that
can
could
hear thunder.
Definitely be it if you've got a thunderstorm.
It's possible. I might say Lena Broca has, I might as well give a spoiler. At one point, the guy tells her story. And she ended up being a victim of human trafficking. Now, estimates are, because statistics are very unreliable, I've seen one estimate that human trafficking in the Philippines right now, they've had 784,000 victims of human trafficking.
Oh, good God.
Yeah. So that's a very common occurrence. She ends up prostituting herself. So when they meet, Broca wanted them to be at equal terms.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what it's like to prostitute herself, and he should know what it's like to prostitute himself.
Right.
In the book, when they meet, he's in a better position. At least I have not, you know. Turn myself into a whore, but there in the film at least, and I think I tend to agree with Brock on this. They meet on equal terms, at least in the film.
So now we're back at the construction site.
Mm-hmm. He's not working there anymore, so.
No, he's looking for a tongue.
I've got. Nothing. There's no...
And now you find out that Atong is dead.
Atong, yep. And this is a very real thing. During the Marcus martial law years, he would have one of his cronies, one of his friends, his allies, would mark out a piece of land for development. And they would try to move the squatters out. Squatters don't want to move. They'll bulldozer the place up. And people have died under the bulldozer blades. Or they'd set fire to mm-hmm. the squatter area to clear them out.
Right.
And I think there's a point there where Atong's father burnt up.
Mm-hmm.
Does he say that?
Yeah, he does say that.
Yep. Okay, I'm going to restart. It's starting to show a signal. Thank goodness. So there are decisions. It follows the book quite closely, but there are... diversions, and it's interesting that Lee Broca felt he had to impose his queerness on the film, and it doesn't stick out. I mean, it does feel like integral to the film, at least the film that I remember.
Right.
People might feel differently. I feel like, well, this works.
queer prostitution is still prostitution.
Right.
You know, it's still exploitation. Although you notice, like, when Ligaia tells her story, she is basically raped. Here, it's persuasive. You don't have to do what you don't want to do. They kind of nudge and follow. It's a more velvety approach.
Right.
Is it still exploitation? Probably. He gets paid a lot of money. More money than he ever seen. This circle of hell may be lower and may be arguably more degrading, but you do get compensated somewhat, which is an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it goes into it at more depth than Midnight Cowboy ever did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think I'm getting full signal. I just need to... I've restarted my computer. Just need to have it boot in, which takes forever.
So just let me know when you're ready, and I'll give you a time.
What's going on right now?
So we've got the woman talking about she's more alone, less here. It looks like Atong's mother.
Mm-hmm. So Sunog Apog was one of his areas with squatter neighborhoods. And I have to say, Manila has a population of 20 million, 21 million. 4 million of those are slum dwellers.
Oh, God.
That's almost a fifth. Almost a fifth people live in illegal slums. And it's always been a problem, and no one, not Marcos, not anyone, has been able to completely solve it. Okay, let's see if we got... Turning on my Chrome.
Okay. When you get to Criterion Channel, let me know.
Sure. It might have improved somewhat. Some of the poverty has been alleviated by some improving economic conditions, but COVID made it worse.
Yeah.
Now the rampant inflation in the Philippines. You know, we talk about inflation in America, but the Philippines is ridiculous. Eggs were the most expensive in the world at one point.
Good Lord. And we complain
said,
about
they
have it here.
Yeah. There was a joke that someone ordered a ham omelet. And they came back with almost all ham, and they said, well, there's not enough egg. It's too much ham, not enough omelet.
Well, you know what? He's talking to his friends, and there's that very famous line, if you give someone a smoked fish, you know, the poor will appreciate it. But the rich will already have had ham, and so you know, the poor are much more easily manipulated, which is very true.
See, he's speaking of Atong's sister Perla.
Right. Okay.
He feels attracted to her. He wants to ask her out. This is Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He's our third companion to the last segment of the film. Chinatown.
Okay.
He's played by Tommy Abuel, excellent actor, also in many Broca and other films. And no internet. That's not true. That can't be true.
I have to reset the internet. I have to do that occasionally.
Yeah, it just had to be now, you know, timing. But
right.
It's like Filipinos. We have a saying, bahala na si Batman. Leave it to Batman. If things screw up, we fly by the seat of our pants. That's a very Filipino style of working.
There you go.
So what we're doing now is we're leaving it to Batman. It sounds better in Tagalog, doesn't it? Bahala na si Batman.
I might have, if I reset it so that it's in a slower resolution, that might be better. That might help. Okay, buffering. What's going on right now?
We've got the two of them and her father suffered burns. Where did they go? No idea. Talking to a woman who is, I think they're trying to find his girlfriend. She's gone to get some yarn.
Okay.
And we're back at the trading company.
Always back there, a recurring theme.
Mm-hmm.
Dang, this is taking forever. Okay, what time have you got?
Okay. I have got 121, 52, 53, 54, so on and so forth. Get close and then I'll give you an exact time.
121, 59 now.
Okay, and I'm at like 122.06, so you're only about 5 seconds behind me. So that's good. Just leave it there.
Okay.
He's looking at the window.
Yes, I see that now.
Okay.
And flashback to Mrs. Cruz. Still looking for his girlfriend.
Right.
And he sees her. Mrs. Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
His hunt's almost over. He found her. They were, pulled together their money to help Perla, the sister, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
He has the money. He was looking for Perla. Now, all of a sudden, he catches Mrs. Cruz. And, of course, a woman being accosted like that, what's the first thing you do? Help police. This guy's trying to steal my purse. You can see his provincialism working here. This guy's a cop. He showed the badge. And he punched him. Knows how to fight. He doesn't have ID. He gives him his diary with Ligaya's letter in it. And he's willing to fight.
Yeah, police not giving them a real good point of view there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So at this point, you know, I told you my wife grew up in Santa Cruz. This is the kind of move that would set off warning lights immediately in her. She's that street smart. This sounds funny. And he just stands there and takes it. He doesn't know what's going on.
No.
He has some idea, but the guy's intimidated. And it's probably one of the most painful scenes in the film. I mean, after all that's happened, it's one of the most painful. Like, should I do it? Should I go check on him? Should I follow him? What should I do? You don't know what to do.
No.
And again, see, getting up to see how you're like waiting, you're not sure what you need to do, what's the right thing to do or whatever.
Indecision. You're stuck.
And
you're
how Lita Brokaw just lingers on the scene, just keeps the shot going. And you're yelling at him, go after the cop, my gosh. You moron. It goes in, it's an eatery. It's a store. Fine.
But beyond the store, that's probably a real waitress.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't recognize her. Beyond the store is billiards.
Billiards place.
With doors and doors. You know, in American buildings, you have one use, and office building is office building, and pool hall is a pool hall. They're like businesses within businesses within businesses. It's a lot like New York, maybe. Some of the more Warren-like structures in New York. That's Metro Manila right there.
Mm-hmm.
And what can you do? You can't do anything. Classic Filipino male tactic. You get drunk. They're probably cheapest thing available is gin. You're probably drinking gin. And that's Paul Tommy Abuel, his friend. I told you this, he's our guide for the last segment, Chinatown.
Right.
And I might point out that it's like Roman Polanski's film. Everything ends up in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
We try to do as little as possible, and the people you love still get hurt. Here we go. Hair trigger response. That's simmering. It's grown up. Probably he's the most fully realized character in this whole film. Everyone else just types, I guess, what he reacts against or he reacts to. So Julio's probably the most fully realized because there's a psychological persuasiveness to how he moves. And he realizes, oh, his hands are gripped. It was a very Bresonian moment, the shift to the hands.
Mm.
And he lowers his hands and he realizes, what am I doing? This is not me. But it is you increasingly, it's more and more you. Because you're reacting. You can't just like not do anything. Not let live through Manila and not let it do anything to you. Manila will change you. It's gone progress. And like I said, this would have been more complicated, and he buys a shack. Ice pick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to bargain him down to maybe a little over, what's that, 10 cents?
Peso.
Peso. That's 1/7 of a dollar.
15 cents.
Imo. Yeah. Imo, the guy who got the job. He went to night school, he got the job. And look at him. He's got a tie. He's got long sleeves. He's got the belt white.
Mm-hmm.
If you're wearing white in a dirty city like Manila, you've got made. You know how to take care of yourself. You're well-groomed. And they're in a second-floor restaurant, air conditioning, I assume. So,
I don't think so.
They'd have mosquito screens, window screens, if it wasn't air-conditioned.
No,
probably air-conditioned. Sheet glass. Okay. And that's probably a real waitress there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about Perla, Atong's sister.
Right.
She disappeared after the fire that probably one of Marcus's goons had set fire to or bulldozed to make way for some development one of his cronies wanted to establish.
Mm-hmm.
And she ended up in the house of prostitution. Again, that pervading theme. Easiest way to make money, sell your body. And Paul is furious. Did Imo have sex with her? And Imo is still lower class, but at least he has a job. He has a steady job. He has a place. I think his mother mm-hmm. takes care of him. So mm-hmm. he's pretty well-to-do, but look at that place. Look how dingy and dirty and cramped it is. Yeah, doesn't it? And Mike Diaz spoke out against this, that, you know, a lot of Filipino films are poverty porn. They're made for film festivals. They make their money by prostituting their poverty. There's a case to be made about that point. Mike Dion made a film later on in the 80s, Aliwan Paradise, where he takes the characters Manila Sakoko, sets them in the future, and in the future, the biggest industry is the entertainment industry, where you prostitute yourself for foreigners, for foreign money.
Mm-hmm.
It's the biggest export in the Philippines will be entertainment. Entertainment and human labor. And damn if he isn't prophetic. And again, the allegorical, he finally sees Ligaya herself, oh my gosh, going into a church. Mm. So look to God, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we
and
haven't,
you will find
okay,
your answer.
You haven't really mentioned that
in terms of the religion. Now, the Philippines are very, very much Catholic, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
If I remember right, the figure's 85%, definitely more than half. 85%
okay.
Catholic. There's a growing segment of Christian. And there are like Christian sects. And they've actually exported
right.
the religion. Christian sect called Iglesia de Cristo. Church of Christ, which has gone to the United States. You have churches in the United States.
I'm familiar, actually. I have played a service at one of those.
The Iglesia de Cristo.
Mm-hmm.
So they have exported. And they meet for the first time in God knows how long. Again, Hilda Coronel, stunningly beautiful.
Absolutely.
There was a magazine, French magazine, when Inchang, her film with Dina Broca, made next year, 1976, went to Cannes, director's fortnight. They took one look at her picture, legend has it, and they took out the picture of the cover girl and put her in a small, the cover girl in a small insert, and put her on the cover. Because she was so gorgeous. And the girl that they displaced was Farrah Fawcett Majors.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And look, this is a Cubao Theater or Manila. I believe Manila Theater showing King of Kings. And you'll see the Nick Ray film playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
The actual film. Which is interesting. The religious element comes in. We find the guy in the church. We're watching a religious film. So on and so forth. Because, of course, she's Joyful Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what else? And here she's pretty good. Law, she doesn't say much.
She doesn't have to.
That's true. And there was a complaint in Inxiang where she's a slum girl. She's too beautiful to be a slum girl. And Lena Broca says, well, she's from the slums. She was a slum girl. Hilda Cornell starts as a slum girl. Then she broke into the movies as a child star.
Mm-hmm.
So she wants to talk somewhere where they're more comfortable. They go to a motel. And why not? They've had sex with other people. Why not with each other, finally?
Yeah.
With someone that you mean, that means something to you.
Right.
They probably dreamt about this business for years. Now she's telling how she was, like, enslaved, basically. They brought the building, the guards outside, high walls. She's going to be interviewed. Now, I'm not sure if you... Yes. This scene, there's Mike DeLeon tells a story about this scene. What's this? Lino Broca wanted a lot of melodramatic music for this scene. The crucial scene where Ligaya tells her side of the story. Mike DeLeon says, no, we should keep it to silence. Lino got so upset. His friend Mario Hara came along, told him to go home, and agreed with Mike DeLeon that there shouldn't be any melodramatic music in the scene, but there should be some music. So he talked to Max Hoxon to come up with something a little understated playing in the background. And as Mike DeLeon said, basically Mario Harris saved the scene from being excessive, and you know, it's beautifully played, the music. And that's Mario Harris' contribution to the movie. That and one other, which I'll point out to you later.
So let's talk a little bit about Mario O'Hara. And tell us a little bit about his background in Filipino film and who he was.
He didn't come from he was in theater, but he was also from radio. He was pursuing an engineering degree, but dropped out because the money from radio was too good. Then he dabbled in stage. Then he met, I believe it's in theater that he met Lino Broca, and Lino Broca used him as an actor in Star Doom, one of his soap melodramas. And in bits and parts here and there. And he used his scripts. He wrote the script for Tinimbang Kang Unikulang, You Were Weighed But Found Wanting, Dino's first art film. Lino Broca, it's basically Lino Broca's life story, but Mario Hara added a lot of things in it. It's his script, basically. He also wrote the teleplay for Insiang, which Lino Broca adapted and turned into, my opinion, his best work, his masterpiece. They were a long-time collaborators. Some people may have said they were lovers. I have it on good stead that they are not. And there's a reason for it, but I can't say why. I'm contractually obligated not to say why. They were not lovers. There's a long time, that's a long-time rumor. Mario Hara and Lino Broca are lovers, they are not. Anyway, so they had a falling out. And again, I'm not at freedom to say why. But Mario Hara had high regard for Lino and probably great affection because in one of his best films, Woman in a Tin Roof, Babay sa Bubungan Lata, he had a photo album showing of the different people who've died in the film industry. In the last picture, the very last frame of the film was a picture of Lino Broca.
Mm-hmm.
And here, there's drug use. Drugs are used to hook sex workers, very common practice. She was denied that because, again, she was too beautiful to get the uglier aspects of prostitution. Atek is her exclusive customer. No other man's had her. Otherwise, she'd be servicing 3 or 4 men a day. And Atek refused to have her hooked on drugs. And he wants to take her for a constant companion, if not a common law wife. I'd say she was in the lower tier, a mistress or, you know, girlfriend.
Right.
Kept girlfriend. Higher in status would be a common law wife. And this did happen. Some wealthy Chinese would do that. But it's not just the Chinese. Some Spaniards would do that. Basically, anyone rich. In the Philippines, you have the money, you can do anything. And then he makes this one-time offer. You live with me, you obey me, I'll take you away from all this. You're basically in a house of prostitution. I told you the figure, 784,000. That's an estimate because there are no hard figures. The Philippine government officially reports over 1,000 have been investigated, successfully prosecuted. That's probably a huge underestimate of the real numbers. Officially, the Philippines has met all the minimum requirements to safeguard against human trafficking. That's on paper. In actual practice, there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of complicity. Government officials participate in even leading sex human trafficking rings.
There's always underhanded things that happen in terms of that. You know, the government and looks the other way and files a form that's not really true and all that. Yeah, I mean, that happens in almost any government.
Sure. It's not a little over 1,000, more like hundreds of thousands. And it's hard to believe that there's just, you know, 1,000 a year. I don't believe that.
Now, just getting back to the film and looking at her doing this and this whole monologue that she has, she really underplays this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you would think in terms like this, you know, and we've talked a little bit about the melodrama involved, that this would be overplayed, but it's not. And to me, that is a real revelation and a really good choice in terms of the direction here by Lena Broca. I mean, you can just see her eyes and downturn of her mouth and the sadness, but it doesn't come into histrionics or anything like that at all. And he's very much, in the way that he's got this framed with her on the one side and him on the other. Even there, she's not overplaying.
Yeah. So she's given a crucial plot point. She can't leave because she has a child, a baby, a daughter, 4 months old. So if she's going to run away, she has to take her daughter with her. She just can't feel like she can leave the girl,
right,
the baby behind. Behind the scenes story, according to Mike DeLeon, Lena Broca was unhappy with this scene and wanted to move the shooting to another day, and Mike DeLeon had to put his foot down. I'm not talking as cinematographer now, I'm talking as producer. You got to finish this scene. And he walks out, gives the camera gels, walks out, tells the assistant cameraman to take over. Or is it? I could get that wrong. He told someone to take over, but he walks out. And they had to finish that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So when push comes to shove, Mike DeLeon can be hard-nosed, pretty hard-nosed.
Oh, yeah.
They can see. Can you imagine if Lena Broca's melodramatic music was used instead of what Mario Harrod suggested? Because Mario came from radio. He knows how to cue in music, when to use it, when not to use it, what kind of music to use.
Mm-hmm.
If you look, watch his films, which someday I hope to do commentary on, you can see how he uses sound and music. He's really good. It comes from radio. Same thing with Orson Welles. Orson Welles is a radio man, and that's what he brought to Citizen Kane.
Well, not that I'm in the same level, but I come from radio too, and that's why we do the podcast like this, where we just talk. We don't do the video. It not only am I comfortable with it, I think it gives more of a focus in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we got a little bit of bleed on your end, by the way. You might want to turn
okay,
it down.
Okay, I'm at 146.31. Where are you?
We're right there. We're right there. I'm talking about the volume. You might want to just cut down the volume a little bit. No, we're at the same place now.
Okay, my bad. Greg Toland taught Orson Welles everything. His unique contribution to film season came with the sound. Went to cue music,
absolutely.
Went to do segues, the sound engineering, the sound design. That was mostly Welles' idea. The overlapping dialogue, bringing them all together in one film.
You know, the other thing, too, is I think the pairing of these two work really well. You could believe that they were together. You could believe that they're a couple and that their interplay and the way they work together.
What's amazing is, you know, for most of the movie, they're not there.
Right.
This is, they said they'll meet around the market. This is around the market. I've been here. It's a whole maze of stalls, meat section, vegetable section. They're in the vegetable section. It's really late. They can see how gradually they're like, they'll be closing down soon. What is it? 6 in the morning? They've pretty much closed down. 6:25.
Then we have the synthesizer music.
Yeah, this is nicely done. But synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
It's standard issue in Filipino films here on out through the 90s at least. I don't know how much they've changed, but they're still using synthesizer music. It's a cheap way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have
absolutely.
Good compositions that helps.
You know, and remember also, we focused on the podcast on micro-budget people, and this is a perfect example of a, you know, ethnic genre from the Philippines where you don't have a lot of money. You're saying this is one of the most funded films that was out there at the time.
One of the better funded.
And still it's $10,000-$20,000. That's not much to work with. So you've got to scrounge and do whatever you can do to get it done. And of course at this point in time, don't forget, you didn't have your iPhone. You didn't have real simple equipment to work with. You had to work with film cameras that were heavy and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, I look at something like this and know that it's done cheaply and look at the look. It looks absolutely gorgeous.
Have you ever seen a wall in any of the entire film that was completely of one color? They always stain, water stains, dirt stains, ash stains.
Well, let me put it this way. If you take a look at the real cheap horror films from the 70s, it's not, and I'm talking American here, it's not that plasterboard, that real, but it's the wood paneling. There are so many films from the early 70s that's all wood paneling, and that was the American version of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tommy Abuelo, who's playing Paul, you can see something's up with him. He's acting funny. He's very more thoughtful than usual. And he's wondering if he should wake up Julio or not. And finally he does. If you don't care for Grace Park, there's always Pasay. Now, Pasay is known as that part of Manila where you can get a lot of nightclubs, a lot of women, a lot of prostitutes. And I might as well put it in here. When Lino made Inchang, he set the film in Tondo. And they were questioned, how come a woman's beautiful Hilda Cornell is staying in a slum like Tondo? In the original teleplay by Mario Harry, he set it in Pasay, and that would make sense. There are a lot of beautiful women in Pasay, and they can't get ahead because there's so many of them. But Lino, again, he cut out that murder in the beginning for Julia's character to complicate Julia's character. And in Inchang, he set her
story in Tondo, a slum area, instead of Pasay. Again, there's this sense that he tends to simplify or cut corners to make things more dramatic. Now, that's kind of a slam, kind of not. He's a hustler, and God bless him, but sometimes you wish he'd go for the subtlety a little more. Acting-wise, he does go for subtlety. He likes the understated acting.
By the way, I have to say something.
Yeah.
That jukebox, I want that jukebox. Okay, go ahead. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. That scene with the motel, the long scene between the two, Julio and Ligaya. Lena was probably unhappy with the way she took the scene, but you have to admit it's a very difficult scene. It's practically like a Shakespearean monologue. And, you know, she's such a young, at 18, can she carry it off? Maybe not. She did the best she can. And Lino, in one of the extras in Criterion, would say, you know, she'll grow as an actress. She'll become one of the finest actresses. Not quite there yet, but she's getting there.
Well, I thought she did very well, considering. I mean, seriously,
you're
not
coming off fresh, and absolutely, that's a good thing you were able to, you know, feel it that way. So off to fresh eyes, yes, she did quite well. Now, here, Paul is acting funny. He's talking on all kinds of topics. Now, he's talking about cigarettes. And what the fuck with the cigarettes?
Yeah.
And he's daring her. It's a dare. Yeah, can you kill? I don't know if you've ever done that, but...
No.
I'm not sure how painful that thing is. I like to think I have a high tolerance for pain, and I might be able to do it. I haven't gotten that drunk yet, so...
No thanks, I ain't doing it. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah. Well, implied is that there's a reason why he's doing this. He's going acting nuts like this. Incidentally, okay. And I'm not sure if there's special effects here. Although you don't actually see the cigarette in the palm, but that makeup's very convincing. That looks like a real burn. And they don't have a lot of money for makeup.
No, you don't.
Yeah, the guy is dead. He didn't notice it, but there was laughter in the background. Laughter sounded artificial and hollow, like it's different. Now he turns up the, I like this, he turns up the laughter. It's nightmarish now. But earlier it was already sounding funny. So he does have some idea of sound engineering, sound design. And an investigative reporter saying there's something funny about the guy's death. She fell down the stairs. And again, I know of someone this happened to. A girlfriend of a rich guy. The girl died. The family, and I know the family, can do nothing. And to add insult to injury, the rich guy paid for the funeral and burial of the girl. They could do nothing about it. So these things do happen. Doesn't have to be Chinese. Can be a rich Filipino, rich someone. In this case, yeah, it was another rich Chinese. And that's the only rain we'll see mourning the guy's death. They probably had the fire truck spraying the street. And that, again, takes some money. And this is what the funeral home in the Philippines looks like. Well, in Manila, looks like very cramped, very claustrophobic.
Okay, we're about ready to go into overtime, just so that anyone knows we're going into overtime here.
I like the way they cut. Ike Harlego, one of the Philippines' greatest editors. Lino just usually gives the editor an idea and then leaves it to the editor to cut. Some people are very finicky about their editing. Mike De Leon is one. Mario Harris, another. Tico Aguiluz. Lino, not so much. He's not into the technical side. It's more about script acting and story. He usually knows what he does, but he depends on the technicals to take care of it for him, especially fight sequences. And this is, I think, North Cemetery. I'm guessing. I told you Mario Haran that Babayes Bugbong and Lata did a film where people actually live in North Cemetery. It's actually a viable option to live out the rest of your days in someone's mausoleum. And there's Apec, Tommy Yap, that regular in Lino Broca's ensemble cast. They probably wouldn't bury her in the Chinese cemetery. And there's a lovely shot. That gray sky. Probably have to wait for the gray sky. And again, that sense of a simmering pot about to boil.
Right.
Because she was the reason he came there. She is the reason why he went through all that. And now she's gone.
Well done. And it's close up. And he's breaking, and you can tell.
He's there. He's at the brink. Misery and revolt. Misericordia and Ompin. And that's Mario Hara.
Oh, okay, cool.
He does a cameo here as the head of an actual anti-Marcos rally. And here's a story. After the shooting was done, two military officers visited that party, the cast party, and invited, quote unquote, Lino Broca and Mike De Leon for questioning. And they got interrogated, and then they took Lino Broca and interrogated him. Lino comes out and says, we're free to go. And Mike asks, what happens? And Lino says, I don't want to talk about it. Turns out some of the people in this rally are actual activists and radicals. And those banners they've taken out from previous rallies they staged against Marcos in the 60s.
Okay.
And because of that rally, he was afraid that the censors would cut the film. They did not. They did not bother cutting the film, but they did insist that Mike De Leon include the words 1970 in the beginning of the film. The implication is all this happened before martial law, and that martial law, the whole Philippines is hunky-dory and just fine. As soon as they sent this to a film festival abroad, I believe the Tehran International Film Festival, Mike De Leon cut out that 1970s title. He didn't want it.
Okay, good.
And again, quintessential noir shots.
Oh, yeah.
Handheld at the face.
That's a handheld camera.
Handheld
got
at the feet.
Shaky cam.
Yeah. And a tracking shot of him walking past. And that looks like a Chinese store.
Mm-hmm.
Complete with weather fans, classic ceiling fans. And slimy streets, very Manila. I feel like I may not know the exact location, but I've walked it so many times before. And he said goodbye to Paul.
The Manila tourist board is not going to like this film, that's for sure.
Yeah. He said goodbye to Paul and gave him back the money he owed him. He borrowed from him.
Mm-hmm. There's your walkway, your stairwell.
Stairs.
Oh,
into
really nice spot.
Apec's apartment, yes. I think Kubrick did something similar for The Killing.
Mm-hmm.
And you catch the maid cleaning the stair landing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to him. And here's something that I missed first few times I saw this. The maid goes in, shuts the gate, but does not lock it, and that's a crucial difference. He steps up to the gate.
Atek comes out, sees the gate is closed, and that's why he felt safe to come close. He doesn't know it's not locked. And then Hitchcock using a woman's scream.
Yeah, that's Hitchcock. Nice. Ouch.
And now, it may look like a silly detail, him crawling away, but he's trying to crawl away from his attacker, so that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can see people gathered outside, and they're wondering what the hell's happened. They can hear the maid scream. And they're running. And this is the big chase. Mike Leonard had actually hired fire trucks to hose down the streets so that the street looks alive. It's like reflecting light off the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a lot of time left, but I'll tell you the story. My grandfather used to show 35mm movies in his basement during Saturday evenings. Family reunion time, and we'd watch. And one of the films he showed was Maynila, Sa Mga Kuko. Lena Broca wanted this in shot near the morning so that when the final thing happens, it'd be dawn, but Mike Leo talked him into shooting it at night. There's one lone spotlight on him.
Mm-hmm.
And they built up the corrugated tin way up high, more than normal. So it looks like he's a trapped animal. And you can imagine me as a 10-year-old watching this, you know. First time I've seen a man cornered. First time I've seen him with all that fear in his face. The tears streaming from his face out of fear. And these men are out to really hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine me as a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Never forget that ending. And you could say that his death is the birth of my love for movies and Filipino movies. Mm-hmm. I could never forget that. That is the start of my lifelong love for Filipino film.
Wow.
There you have it.
Very well done. Thank you for this. Very much so. I'm so glad we did this. And if you have any others that you want to do, particularly Filipino, let's make this like a once a month if we can do. I'm serious.
Well, I don't know about once a month, but definitely I'd like to do Inshang, which is on Criterion. And I believe that is Lena Broca's masterpiece.
Okay, well let's think about August or September, and
yeah.
You just let me know when it fits in your schedule. Because I'll tell you something. This is, we've talked about this offline, where I should know more about Filipino films. What I know is back in the 50s and early 60s, the horror movies that came out with Eddie Romero and so on and so forth. But this is completely different. And this is something mm-hmm. that I need to find out more about. So please, let's do some more films. I'm serious about that.
I appreciate your interest, and thanks for giving me the chance to talk about this big time.
Well, I tell
you see Mara Harris credited.
As far as I'm concerned, you should be doing this for pay when they put these out on Blu-ray. Seriously. You want my
They've got that
opinion.
To know that they're connected people. You know how it is. It's who you know.
True, but at least, you know, you can use this as a audition piece. And I'm not kidding about that. You should. Seriously.
Thank you.
So there you go. All right, folks. I want to thank everybody for listening. Noel, you're always welcome back, whatever you want to talk about. Let's do another film. This was really something. I'm so glad we did this. And
thank you very much.
For
appreciate
here.
The chance.
Absolutely. Well, folks, I think at this point we're going to say good night. Thank you very much for joining us, and hope you enjoyed it. All right? Thank you. Thanks a lot, Noel. You take care of yourself, all right?
You too. Bye.
All right. Good night, everyone.